You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Now, this notion of using tabletop tests to probe quantum and gravitational effects also came up in the context of building quantum clocks in FQXI's new report on the nature of time, produced in partnership with the John Templeton Foundation. The report is written by science journalist Kate Becker, who had the daunting task of reviewing many centuries' worth of thought about time and condensing it into just 60 pages. Becker spoke to me earlier about the vast range of questions she tackles, spanning multiple scientific disciplines.
Well, I think one of the things that made this report really appealing to write and really exciting for me was that instead of just focusing in on one research program, I was really able to look at a broad spectrum of them, and indeed to go back in time and think about how each of these research programs relates to big questions about time that people have been pondering for more than 1,000 years. And so being able to take that big picture perspective was really fun for me, as well as the fact that in this case, I got to look at the work of scientists who are studying the neuroscience and biology of time, which was completely new for me. And so exploring how their approaches in some cases have resonances and harmonies with what physicists are doing, and in some cases seem almost completely separate, as if they're talking about totally different subjects. That was really fascinating for me.
You've mentioned that a lot of these are ancient puzzles that philosophers have been pondering for centuries. What are the big mysteries about time that scientists today are able to investigate in new ways?
I mean, I think one of the central mysteries is a question of, is time real or is it some sort of illusion? And another way of thinking of that is kind of the tension between a presentist perspective, where the present moment, the current moment, is really all that is real, and an eternalist perspective, where the present moment isn't actually special at all, and everything that has ever been and will ever be exists, even though from our perspective, we aren't free to travel backward and forward in time in the way that we are free to travel backward, forward, up and down, and right and left in space.
So does physics offer one clear answer about whether time is real or an illusion, or do different theories suggest different views?
No, I would say the physicists are all over the map about this. The eternalist perspective is kind of represented by the block universe idea, which comes out of general relativity. And the idea here is that you can envision the entire universe, past, present, and future, as a four-dimensional block. And I think that's a very hard idea for us to get our minds around, because we have this very persistent and sort of inescapable notion that we are moving through time. And even though subjectively the rate at which we're moving through time may seem to change, right? Sometimes it seems like, oh, this is just dragging on forever. Sometimes time seems to go by in a flash. We nonetheless have a sense that time is moving and that the future is open and that the past is set.
And the report, I should say, contains some excellent graphics to help visualize things like the block universe and help explain why people in relative motion can disagree on how to slice through that block, and also thus disagree on what's happening now and the order of events. Of course, we'll be putting a link to the report on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, and I encourage listeners to go and take a look at it now, scroll through, you know, have a read, but also look at some of those diagrams, because they're really lovely, actually. But Kate, you've given us the notion of time in general relativity. What about quantum theory? Because their time is conceived differently.
Right. So in quantum physics, which we're accustomed to thinking about as kind of where all the weirdness happens, the view of time is actually quite traditional. So most folks who are studying quantum theory, while they accept uncertainty about position and momentum and all of that, there is still a universal clock that is running in the background of these experiments. And so while from a relativistic perspective, that universal clock simply doesn't exist, it's kind of a given in many quantum mechanics experiments. And so this is one of those places where relativity and quantum theory have a disconnect. And the fact that this is one of those kind of breaking points suggests that if you can find a way to bring quantum theory and relativity into some consensus about time, perhaps you can actually come to a unification between those two theories. But how to actually do that is something that there's no clear answer or consensus on yet.
Okay, so unifying quantum gravity is a massive endeavor. FQXI has funded a lot of efforts into this, and yet somehow it still hasn't been solved. Part of the reason is that it is impossible to see how to set up an experiment that will test conditions where quantum gravity holds sway, like in the center of a black hole or at the birth of the universe. But one theme that's come up with a number of speakers on this edition of the podcast is the idea of probing aspects of the interaction between quantum and gravitational effects in tabletop tests.
Yeah, this is an interesting moment because now for the first time, there are really efforts to do some tabletop tests in the lab exploring some of these ideas. And the basic idea is to use a natively quantum system as a clock and see how things unfold from there.
Well, since this edition is filled with physicists describing the form such tests might take, let me refer listeners to your report for more details and ask you instead about another huge conundrum that you talk about in the report, time's arrow. Why does time flow in one direction? No pressure there, Kate, but why do I get older each day instead of younger? Why?
So the basic idea is that the arrow of time is linked to the concept of entropy. And for some reason that we're still trying to figure out, the universe began in a state of very low entropy and is evolving towards states of higher entropy that we experience as aging, as broken eggs not coming back together again, as our dinners not uncooking themselves. I mean, I think one of the big questions here is why did the universe have a low entropy beginning, because that seems to be a very low probability state. And to study that, there are folks who are looking at astrophysical observations, for instance, looking at the cosmic microwave background radiation, and confirming that indeed they do see that low entropy state. But as for the why, I think that's still very difficult to explain. Folks like Sean Carroll are looking at explanations that invoke a multiverse, but I think that's still very much an open question.
There's more about those possible solutions from physicists in a chapter dedicated to time's arrow in the report. So let me ask you, Kate, there are lots of open questions to be answered. Are physicists getting any help from, or are they giving any help to, biologists and neuroscientists who are also thinking about time?
That's an interesting question. Are they getting any help, or are they of any help? It does often feel as if they are just speaking different languages when it comes to folks who are looking at the biology. And yet there are these interesting areas of overlap. One that Dean Buonamano points out in his book, Your Brain is a Time Machine, which I thought was really kind of an elegant one, has to do with the spatialization of time. So when we look at general relativity, we think of how time is treated in a sense as a spatial dimension. And one of the things coming out of the neuroscience work that I thought was really interesting was the observation that to some extent, we tend to think about time in spatial terms. You can move backward and forward in time. You can go ahead and behind. So there's this kind of repurposing of language that led some neuroscientists to ask whether there's also a kind of repurposing of the same neural circuits. And there was a really interesting experiment looking at folks who, because of a brain injury, they experience what's called spatial neglect. So they lose awareness of kind of one half of their perceived world. And in this experiment, they were actually able to show that folks who lose awareness of the left half of their perception are less able to remember events that occurred in the past in a story. So that's kind of using an axis for time where the left represents things in the past and moving to the right represents things in the future. And so I thought that connection between how our language spatializes time and how our brains do so was really interesting. In addition to the fact that when you look for similar language parallels in languages that aren't written from left to right, you find them again, but along the axes that those other languages use, whether that's going from right to left, whether it's that it is vertical, or even in cultures where they use only east and west or geographical landmarks to express spatial movement, they also use that same sort of language to describe time.
Yeah, that really is fascinating. And again, you know, you have a chapter dedicated to the biology of time perception in the report. Now, Kate, one of the reasons FQXI knew you would be the ideal person for looking into this subject is because you've written a huge number of articles based on FQXI's grant round on the nature of time a few years back. Given your extensive experience covering these subjects, did you find anything in the report surprising?
Oh, I like that question. Perhaps this seems obvious, but just how difficult it really is to define time. And so looking at the different ways that different scientists, different philosophers over time, have defined it and have divided it into different flavors was really useful. Because I think as in so many things, the more you try to think about something, the more you try to write about it, the more you discover that your own internal understanding and internal definition is actually harder to pin down than you ever thought it was. And so that was an interesting experience as well. Another thing that I discovered, I wouldn't say that my mind was changed about it, but perhaps I have more of a sense of just how deep the questions go and just how unsettled the questions are. And I'm more able perhaps to see what's happening now as part of this long line of questioning that does go back 1,000 years at least, and which is connected not just to physics, but to so many scientific fields, including biology and neuroscience. You know, one of the things that continued to be interesting as I was talking with the scientists was, as we learn more about the physics of time, it often seems like the gap between what we talk about in ordinary conversation and what physicists talk about is just growing larger and larger. And I think it will be interesting to see whether that is a gap that further progress in the field eventually closes. You know, will we find that this dissonance was due to the fact that the science just hadn't advanced far enough? Or will this dissonance be something that really is fundamental? And I don't know the answer, but I think it's an interesting question.
Thank you to Kate Becker for talking with you earlier. There's a link to the FQXI report on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, along with a story that Zia wrote, inspired by the report's discussion of retrocausality called the Sudoku Universe on the Templeton website.
Yes, retrocausality is an interpretation of quantum theory in which the future can influence the past, which comes up in some detail in a chapter of Becker's reports on time and quantum theory. We didn't talk about it much in that interview, but you can find out more about it through the links on the podcast page. And of course, in the report itself.